Take it away, Bob.
Good morning, everybody. Grab a cup of coffee and a seat. We're going to get started. Well, good morning, and thanks for coming out on a dreary day. David asked me to say a word of introduction for Annie Campbell. Annie and I have been friends for a long time. She and Ben, her husband, were the founders of Richmond Hill, which is a residential Christian community that focuses their peripheral attention on the healing of our metropolitan area. And she did that for a long, long, long time. Annie is also a school teacher, and she did that for a long time as well, and did it very, very well. And in fact, at one point, she was nominated for Teacher of the Year in the Richmond Public Schools. And as it turned out, she was the first runner-up. But Annie and I both know that she was destined to be the Teacher of the Year. Annie is a storyteller. And her assignment is to talk about spiritual formation. And that's the challenge. So, Annie, without further ado, come on up and tell us about it.
Thank you, Bob. Yeah.
I said to Ben this morning, Bob's introducing me, and I bet you anything he says I was first runner-up and not winner of Teacher of the Year. That was a lesson in humility, which is part of spiritual formation. I was sure I was going to be Teacher of the Year. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't be. And as two of us stood on the stage, waiting for the winner to be announced, I was preparing my gracious remarks and heard and first runner-up, which gave me a time minute to catch my breath, is Annie Campbell. And I'd seen Miss America a million times. So I knew I was to smile graciously and look pleased for the winner. And I somehow pulled that off. And then the winner stepped up to the microphone and said, God is in this. And at that point I was like, really, God? Bob picked up the pieces the next night when we had a long conversation about it. And Bob being Bob, one of my two favorite priests, David May being the other, and we're not counting Ben Campbell because he's disqualified being married to him. But that's not the story I was going to start with. I want to start with the story of this gold bracelet, because our Christian formation, we design Christian formation as carefully as we can, but our formation really is built through stories, and some of them happen around church. And we piece together our image or our feeling of God. I was the firstborn. My Episcopal street cred is tight. I was baptized at Bruton Parish. My father was a diplomat, so I was confirmed at St. George's Cathedral in Jerusalem. Ben and I were married at St. George's in Fredericksburg. So being the firstborn, it never occurred to me not to go to church. Get in the car. This is what you believe. It's time to get confirmed. This was my spiritual formation. People telling me to believe in God and me believing in God. Of course, it couldn't stop there, but that was a big piece of it. So imagine my surprise when my mother said, "Elliot," to my sister, "you need to get confirmed." And Elliot said, "Not this year." And the following year, my mother said, "Elliot, you need to be confirmed. This is getting embarrassing," because you know how Episcopalians are. Elliot said, "I can't get confirmed because I don't believe in the Nicene Creed." And I am like, wait, it's an option not to believe in the Nicene Creed? It's an option not to get confirmed? And my mother said, "You don't need to believe in it. We're Episcopalians. You just have to be open to believing it." And my sister said, "Well, there's a bigger problem than that. I don't even believe in God." And here's where it really gets dicey. My mother took off her gold bracelet and she said, "Elliot, this was given to me by my godmother at my confirmation at St. Anne's in Annapolis. And if you get confirmed, no matter what you believe, I'll give this gold bracelet to you." Now, this gold bracelet has all of our teeth marks on it because we all teethed on it. And I could not believe that my mother was bribing my sister, who had just said she doesn't believe in God, and nobody blinked, by the way, was bribing my non-God-believing sister into getting confirmed at Bruton Parish Church. And my sister took the gold bracelet, put it on her wrist, and said, "Thank you very much, I'll do it." The rainy Sunday came. It was like this. The confirmation class that consisted of my sister and two brothers made their way to the altar rail. The bishop laid his hands on their heads, and when he got to my sister, lightning struck. She stood up and faced the congregation at Bruton Parish Church, where Coatsworth Pinckney Lewis III was rector. Took off the gold bracelet, faced the congregation, and said, "I told you it was hypocritical." I knew nothing would happen till we got in the car, because that's the way it worked in my family. We took our places in the back seat, that second seat of the station wagon. My father adjusted the rear view mirror so that he had Elliot right in his eye. And he said, "Elliot, honey, you make a very poor atheist if you thought that lightning was all about you." There was a lot of Christian formation in that story, wasn't there? My takeaway was that atheists are just not yet Christians. I had further proof, another story of Christian formation. My brother, don't ask me how, it's all birth order. You know, I was the firstborn. So that's how I ended up standing in St. Mary's Episcopal Church on a rainy Sunday morning doing adult forum, talking about Christian formation in the church. Firstborn. My brother went into a coma as an agnostic and was not expected to ever come out. And he came out as a full-blown, having remembered every collect he ever heard, Christian. That was an important part of my formation as a Christian, because it confirmed what happened in that station wagon all those years ago, that my brother went in as not yet. And here he emerged. And so whenever somebody, of course, Episcopalians don't say this to me, but at Richmond Hill, which was ecumenical, every now and then people would say, "Please pray for my mother, my uncle, my brother, my father. They are very sick and unsaved." And I always would tell that story about my brother, because it undergirds my belief that Jesus catches everybody on the way out. Let's back up a little bit. So formation, even that word, we never think about it. The wonderful thing about our church and the prayer book is that we don't really have to think about any of it. You know, what happened to my sister and my brother? All of those Sundays, we're working on them. We're like river rocks. We don't have sharp edges of damnation and this or else and all of that kind of thinking. That's not who we are as Episcopalians. We're river rocks. The words flow over us like water, week after week after week after week, and we have round, smooth edges of this I believe. Well, what do you believe? Well, it's like this. It's like a lost coin. It's like a pearl of great price. It's like someone coming home. It's a prodigal son. It's his oldest brother. How does this happen? I'm going to give a little bit of context for our church. Like formation in what church? And like any good teacher, and I became a teacher 43 years ago, and this is my first year of not being a teacher, not that kind of teacher. But any good teacher starts with a little pre-assessment to see where her students are. So I'm just going to give you a little multiple choice test. I'm not going to pick up the papers. There's no grade. I want you to think about it. Our church began with a king who didn't like his wife and had an eye for a saucy wench of noble birth in the household, so he needed a divorce. B, a king who had a wife who wasn't producing an heir and he needed another wife, so he needed a divorce. C, a king who had wide and varied appetites and simply could not be monogamous, so he needed a divorce. D, all of the above. Just quickly turn to the person next to you and see what you think it is. What'd you all come up with? Okay, so that would be King Henry, and he gets a lot of credit for the beginning of the Anglican Church because he did need a divorce, all of the above. But all he really did was fire the Pope, who wouldn't give him a divorce, appoint himself as defender of the faith, and the church stayed the same. Didn't change a thing. So he doesn't really get a lot of credit for our identity. Then there's Edward, who gets credit for the creation of the Book of Common Prayer, but he was a young and sickly king and died young. So I'm not sure he really gets the credit. There's Thomas Cranmer, who gets a lot of credit because of a lot of the language that we still say on Sundays was created by him based on some other things. This is the beautiful thing about not having been to seminary, because if I get it wrong, I say, well, it's not like I've been to seminary. But so far, I think I'm right. How am I doing, ordained people? So then Edward goes, well, Mary, his sister, Henry's daughter, does not get the credit because she flipped Reformation into restoration to the Catholic Church and burned a lot of dissidents at the stake along the way. And then there's Elizabeth, her half-sister. And she gets quite a bit of credit for our identity. Not so much of what she did to the Book of Common Prayer. She did do a couple of things that are important. But her imagination gives us our identity. Her desire for a way that included everybody. the Puritans, the Calvinists, the Roman Catholics, honoring her parents. How could she include all of this? Well, I think Elizabeth was a big reader of Erasmus. Do I know it? No, but I know that she was a big reader. And I know that Erasmus was a big thinker of the Renaissance, and his work would have fallen into her hands. And he certainly came up with a way called the Via Media, the middle way, trying to find a place for everybody. She appointed this guy named Richard Hooker to help her imagine this. And he was able to take the tension of scripture, which the Puritans were all about, and tradition, which the Catholics were all about, and balance it with this third leg on this three-legged stool called reason. I think she might have read the spiritual exercises of Ignatius, who was all about imagination, imagining the gospel, putting yourself in the gospel. She had a correspondence with her distant cousin, James I, who was responsible for the King James Version of the Bible and Jamestown. And they had a friend, they never met, but they had an epistolary relationship. I love saying that word. They wrote letters to each other, and theirs was a friendship called a friendship among equals, which is such a beautiful phrase. And they had a friend in common. We know it just because of the fly leaves of plays and things. Their common friend was William Shakespeare. And what came out of this triad of genius? The words that we pray that are written in the meter of our mother's heartbeat, set by the metronome of our mother's womb. Be still and know that I am God. And those words are as natural to us as breathing, so that we don't always think about it. Now, our world has changed a lot since Elizabeth. But the Renaissance was a time of fire, literally a spark caught fire. And I will tell you, I had to learn the hard way. I double majored in English and history, and I always matched up my courses so that I could write some of the same papers for both courses. But the problem with taking Renaissance and Reformation history and the English, the literature of the English Renaissance, is they didn't happen at the same time. So when I wrote my cultural paper for Shakespeare on Queen Elizabeth's revisions of the Book of Common Prayer, I found out that I was not going to be able to hand that into my history course because it was out of sync. And also that there weren't that many revisions that Elizabeth made. She took out all the ugly language of the Pope, and she made the Eucharist more hospitable for people who thought that it was representative, or for people who believe it's the actual presence. There's room for both to kneel or side by side at the altar rail. So what I know is that imagination sparked the Renaissance, and that literacy took the world like wildfire. Daniel Pink, who writes now, says that gradually we became less imaginative as people and more left brain. Because as we read, reading left to right, left to right, left to right, we have more origin in our left side of our brain, making us more analytical, more linear in our approach to faith. So in the Renaissance, when they were becoming more analytical, it was balancing the fire of imagination. And imagination is something that we hold very dear in the tradition of our formation. I want to just read a couple of things to you, and I want you to listen with the right side of your brain. I'm just going to pull some lines out here. This is actually more recently written. This isn't from Elizabethan times, but I love this line. It's in the style of, Almighty and eternal God, so draw our hearts to you. So guide our minds. So fill our imaginations. So control our wills that we might be wholly yours. Where is will in that sequence? Mind, imagination, heart, mind, imagination, will. Just feel that for a minute. On All Saints Day, the ineffable joys. What does ineffable mean? You can't put it into words. You can sense it. You can feel it. It's too deep for words. I love this prayer from the ordination service. O God of unchangeable power and eternal light, look favorably on your whole church, that wonderful and sacred mystery. O God of searing truth and surpassing beauty. This is the and Lesser Feast and Fast for C.S. Lewis. We give you thanks for Clyde Staples Lewis, whose sanctified imagination lights fires of faith in young and old alike. Surprise us also with your joy. This from Elizabeth Barrett Browning. Earth's crammed with heaven and every common bush afire with God, but only he who sees takes off his shoes. The rest sit around and pluck blackberries. Or this from Mary Oliver, who really, honestly, I don't know how you have Lesser Feast and Fast without Mary Oliver and Wendell Berry in there. It'll happen one day. Pay attention. Be astonished. Tell about it. And then this also by Mary Oliver. The world offers itself to your imagination. Now, I played a little trick with that multiple choice test. There really should be an E, none of the above. Because our church, as churchy as we may be, does not begin with King Henry. Where does it begin? Is it in the announcement of an angel to a young girl? Is it in the visitation of two cousins, women expecting a baby? Does our church begin in a cave in Bethlehem? Does our church begin in a carpenter shop with father and son? In a synagogue with the unfurling of scrolls in Capernaum? On a boat in Galilee or in the fishnets left behind on a shore? At the rim of a well in a conversation? Does it begin with a woman sitting at the feet of a teacher while her sister noisily and resentfully washes dishes in the next room? Does it begin with a supper that not everybody knows is the last? Does it begin in an empty tomb? In an upper room with fish on a beach, with friends on the road and hearts burning within them? Does our church begin with St. Paul and his formation. Because I feel like we're close enough now that I can tell you what formation is. I wouldn't dare walk into an Episcopal church and say in one word what formation is. Are you ready? It's conversion. A synonym of formation is conversion. So when we're talking about formation, we're talking about conversion. But conversion with a slow motion conversion with a little oomph that has an end point, which is transformation. The transformation of the inner life shaped by the community around us. Well, what about St. Paul? What about St. Paul on that road to Damascus, thrown from a horse, blinded by the light, sight restored, unfolding heart knowledge that Jesus is Lord? What about that? Isn't that a conversion? Even there is the starting point of conversion. The conversion takes place through a life of letters to the community, shaping both the community and Paul. Formation and transformation. So if formation is about conversion, what about us? Well, it starts somewhere. And if I asked you right now, where did formation start for you? There would be a million different stories in this room. There's so many that you could come up with. Most of you are coming up with more than one right now. And there might have been a big experience, and then there's the experience after or the experience before. Maybe formation begins for you as it does for me in the smell of just blown out candles. I had a rector once, St. George's in Fredericksburg, and I was on the Christian Education Committee, and I was unsure where to go with our preschoolers. And Charles Sidner said, God is only as good as the cookies taste at coffee hour to a preschooler. So maybe it's in the taste of the cookies at coffee hour. Maybe there's a teacher, a minister, a relationship, a friend. Maybe you, like me, it was my father. No matter who would or wouldn't get in the car, made sure that I got in the car every Sunday. I think probably all of us have had that moment in a pew where words that were written in 1549 spring to life like we've never heard them before. Or there's a song of a hymn, or there's a word in a sermon, or there's a baby in the arms of a priest at a font, or there's kneeling at the rail, there's the host on our tongue. There are Sundays that are dry and empty, but something holds us there. Or there are Sundays that are dry and are empty, and nothing holds us there, and yet still we come back. One of the most beautiful, beautiful things of our church is that vision that Elizabeth had, that there is room for all of us at that altar rail, no matter where we are in our story. I want to get this right. I do not want to mispronounce this, and I don't think I wrote it down. I didn't write it down. And this is really bad. This is going to weaken my cred up here as an adult formation speaker. But I'll do the best I can. I think it's Matthew 26, where someone comes up and says, Jesus, really, what is this all about? And Jesus goes back to the Deuteronomy of his childhood. And he says, this is the great commandment, that you love God with all your mind, all your heart, and all your soul. And then he goes on and says, the second is like unto it. Love your neighbor as yourself. So that first part is the Shema Yisrael. It's hear, O Israel. And that second part, of course, is part of the Ten Commandments. But what I love about our particular lens in the prism of God's kingdom, which is what church is, that's denominations, are just fractured light of something bigger and something whole. What I love about the color that spills from our piece of the lens is the sign that hangs in front of every or near every Episcopal church, which is the Episcopal church where we love our God with all our mind and all our heart and all our soul, welcomes you, which is loving our neighbor as ourselves, that we make room for everybody. Now, formation, our identity is part of formation, but it's not the same as formation. Is everybody with me on that through my very right-brained presentation of that fact? That we're river rocks without jagged edges? So yes, it's true that it's part of our identity that we call the vestibule a narthex, that we say nave, not sanctuary, that we say chancel, not front of the church. But we have to be very sure that that doesn't become a kind of insider baseball that leaves everybody else standing in the outfield, because that's not the Episcopal Church welcomes you. The visual of that sign in your head is a really good test. I always found it curious that part of our denomination broke away from us over that sign. And the breakaway congregations do not have a sign hanging outside of their church that says, this church welcomes you. I mean, it just, this is who we are. So all of those churchy terms and the insider chat that makes us us are like egg whites in a chocolate souffle. They add shape and they add refinement, but they're not the main ingredient. So I was not going to be able to get out of here without a food metaphor. So we have these colors. We have this lectionary. We have these seasons. And they're all very important. And if I asked you, if you totally get this and you're completely cool about it, well, I think, you know, David and Bob and Ben might raise their hands because they had to take ordination exams. But I think there's a place in a lot of us where we feel apologetic. Like, well, okay, why is green the color of ordinary time? Well, I can tell you it's because it shows growth. But I never know whether these meanings come up before or after the design. So if you don't completely get it, you're not supposed to. Our lectionary and our liturgical year is the Groundhog's Day of church. Raise your hand if you've seen Groundhog's Day. All right, well, in Groundhog's Day, Bill Murray has to live, it happens to be Groundhog's Day, over and over and over again until he gets it right. And do you know what happens to him as he lives it over and over and over again? He gets it right. You could say that Groundhog's Day is really a story about the formation of Bill Murray's character, or the conversion of Bill Murray's character. I'm going to talk about children's formation next week. I haven't talked about that much this week, because this is the foundation of what formation is for all of us. But I will say this. If you want to give a little boost to your own ongoing formation, I don't think we spend enough time on the colics in church. That's what I was reading to you from. I was reading to you from a group of colics. And if you want to understand the seasons as you live through them, the collect is a really good place to start. And reading it with the right side of your brain, with your imagination, letting the words wash over you like water washes over river rocks. I need to make sure of my time. All right. I want to tell you a story about getting it right and not getting it right. Because right along with that sign, the Episcopal Church welcomes you. Church, spiritually, is a come-as-you-are proposition. And if we get lost in feeling like there's only one right way to do this, we can get lost. This story is recorded in one of Tolstoy's short stories called The Three Pilgrims. But it's older than that. He incorporated it. And it tells of a bishop in the 5th century who wanted to make sure that everybody that he was in charge of knew the Lord's Prayer and knew how to say it perfectly. And he heard that there were 3 hermits living on this island praying all the time, but he also knew that no one had taught them how to pray the correct way. So he got this boat to take him over to the island, and the 3 hermits were standing there with their arms outstretched and looking upward. And as he came to shore, they welcomed him. And he said, "My good men, I understand that you are praying all of the time." And the men nodded, and the bishop said, "Well, well, tell me how it is. What are you saying? Tell me what you pray." And the hermits stepped forward and in unison said, "We are 3. You are 3. Have mercy upon us." "No, no, no," said the bishop. "That won't do." And he spent the entire day making sure they had the sequence just right. Our Father, who art in heaven. What was the first part? And it went like that all day. The sun set, the moon rose. The bishop left feeling satisfied that he had saved these 3, that they now knew how to pray. And as he looked out on the moonlight rippling across the water, he was satisfied. Then he looked out and he saw the 3 hermits running across the water toward him. He looked up in horror and said, "Stop! What is this?" "It's nothing, Bishop. It's just that we forgot the words to your prayer." And the bishop said, "We are 3. You are three. Have mercy upon us. Pray nothing else. So start where you are. Let the words of our faith, the meditations of your hearts, the sacraments that are offered to us, by us, for us, wash over you, smoothing the jagged edges. Take off your shoes. Imagine. Pay attention. Be astonished. Tell about it. Leave your perfectionism outside the door with your dripping umbrellas. Remember that liturgy means work of the people. Christianity, not even in the Episcopal Church, is a spectator sport. It's not performance art. Our formation is the transformation of our hearts over time, shaped by the communities in which we find ourselves. A young monk went to a desert father and said, "Father, I am doing everything just right. I am keeping my little rule. I am reading scripture. I am meditating. I am praying. What else can I do?" And it's said that Father Anthony, the desert father, stretched out his arms and his fingers burst into flame. And he said, "Why not be transformed into fire?" Thank you. We do, I think, have time for questions, do we, Bob? I tried to leave a little bit of time.
I've got a question.
Yes.
What are the personal spiritual practices for you that have been most helpful on your spiritual journey?
Good. I'm glad we're closing with that, because that's something that we're going to talk about next time. But this might get you started in thinking about that. So Bob is saying, what are my personal spiritual practices? And what Bob is really saying is, what's my rule of life? That's what that is. Your personal spiritual practices develop into your rule of life. So I love that question, and I would love for you all to ask that to each other over time. I wake up in the morning, and I write for 10 minutes. And I never look at that writing again. But I write. And I consider that to be a spiritual practice, because I have what the Buddhists would call monkey mind. I wake up with busyness. And if I'm writing with a pen, not on a computer, with a pen, I can only think about the words that I'm writing. And it empties my mind. Then I'm a little embarrassed, because this does involve technology, but I'm probably not the only buddy in here. There's something called Praying the Hours, which Phyllis Tickle, she wrote a beautiful autobiography, by the way. She was just a great thinker in the Episcopal Church. And she developed something called the Divine Hours, Praying the Hours. And the Vineyard Church in Ann Arbor, Richmond, and Ann Arbor, Michigan, has that online. You can type in Google, Praying the Divine Hours, Vineyard Church. And I I pray those psalms that are there. I just read them and pray them. I'm not thinking, what does this mean? What's the meter? Where's the poetry? What? I'm just literally letting those words wash over me. And I read the gospel. I do read the collect for the upcoming week all week long. The same kind of thing. Of course, we would all consider some kind of service a spiritual practice, and that is a part of my day, not my morning, but that is a part of my day. Gratitude is a personal practice, and that is how I close my day. And reaching out to others is a personal practice. So it doesn't sound like a spiritual practice, but that thank you note that I'll write later this morning, I'm not on a typewriter, Kitty. We've laughed about thank you notes. but that thank you note that'll go out later this morning is that it's that human contact, that reaching out. Any other questions? Not that I could answer them. Really, you leave Q&A not because the person up here can answer the questions, but to allow your questions to formulate, just to give a minute.
I like ending on what you just said.
Yeah, to reflect on that this week and reflect on what your practices already are. Read the collect for next week. Yes.
Mm-hmm. If I understood you correctly, you're saying that the Episcopal Church starts at the birth of Christ. Why doesn't it start in the beginning?
You know, it really should have. I could have. I don't really know. You'll notice I gave a lot of possible beginnings. I didn't say where it began. And it should have. I should have started within the beginning. Or the burning bush. Or Moses coming down from the mountain. Any of those places. Thank you.
Thank you, Manny.
Excuse me.